insurance. Andrea?
So we have two series of papers to go through today. We're going to start with the agenda paper 2 series, which has two papers on the transition for entities that had previously applied IFRS 9. Then we look at tying off the mirroring approach and then a review of presentation and disclosures. So, and then we'll move on to paper 14 series. So let's start with 2A and it's Julia.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Good afternoon. Agenda paper 2A discusses classification measurement of financial assets on transition to the new insurance contract standard for entities that already applied IFRS 9. It first just discusses the reassessment of business model and specifically scope of the reassessment and whether it should be optional or mandatory. And then it discusses application of all transition reliefs for classification and measurement of financial assets and related disclosure requirements. With that, moving to the scope of reassessment of business model. This talks about that the reassessment of the business model for managing financial assets on transition to the new insurance contract standard is one measure in a package of measures that address concerns about different effective dates of IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standard. We therefore think that in the first instance, the ISB should consider the scope of the deferral approach and the overlay approach, and consider whether the scope of either of those approaches is appropriate for the reassessment of business model, as opposed to developing an altogether different scope. We think that the scope of the overlay approach, that is designating financial assets that are related to insurance contracts, is appropriate for the reassessment of business model. This is because this approach would be available for a wide range of entities, but at the same time, it will exclude financial assets that are clearly unrelated to insurance activities. The staff recommendation is set out in paragraphs 22 to 24 of agenda paper 2A. Do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Surprise, surprise.
Moving on to question 2. So the staff recommends that the reassessment of business model should be optional rather than mandatory. This is mainly because concerns about different effective dates of IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standard do not arise for all entities that issue insurance contracts, and therefore we think that entities that do not have such concerns should not be forced to perform the reassessment of the business model. In addition, we also think that the designation approach, which the board just decided to adopt for the reassessment of business model, is naturally lends itself better to an optional approach rather than mandatory. And finally, we know that other approaches, overlay approach and deferral approach, are also optional rather than mandatory. Staff recommendation is set out in paragraph 29. Do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Mary? I'm not sure whether this is a disagreement with the staff recommendation or a question about wording and whether we need a bit more context for it. But when I think about IFRS 9, classification and measurement in the business model, one of the things that Sue has successfully beaten into me is that business model is a matter of fact. It is not a matter of, you know, designation or intent. And so therefore it seems kind of when I first sat down and read this, it sounded at odds with the, you know, with the fact-based determination that IFRS 9 requires. Now looking quickly at IFRS 9, and so this may not be picking up all its nonsenses and fluency, that says in section 4.4, when and only when it changes the business model for managing financial assets, you reclassify all affected items. So I think the first question that is should not be elective but rather mandatory is the question of whether adoption of the new insurance standard has caused a change in the business model that requires a reclassification. Now, in addition, I think what the staff may be trying to get to in this paper is for instances that would not rise to the level of a change in business model, are we providing a one-time relief to do a, as if you were doing the assessment for the first time, is there stuff at the margin? But that, that nuance didn't come through to me in the drafting. So the first question is, what did the staff actually intend to say? And then if it's the second more nuanced one, I think maybe we need a preamble and making it clear, because I accept your arguments in respect of the second one, but not the first one.
Okay. And definitely the staff intention was the second one, and maybe we can clarify this further in drafting. But it is exactly what we intended, that a change in a business model in IFRS 9 is a very high threshold. And if that threshold is met, an entity is required to reclassify affected financial assets. What we're talking about here is a relief, and it is sort of a subtle change in facts and circumstances, if you will, which does not meet the threshold for a change in business model. But yet, when the entity makes assessment at a different date, it might come to a different conclusion compared to when it did its original assessment sometime in the past. So that's exactly what we're trying to capture in that relief.
Maybe just to, I guess, complement what was said by Yulia, because I had the initial reaction as the same as Mary, but then when I went to the application guidance and the situations mentioned in the application guidance, I thought, well, we do need to fine-tune here, because if we go straight to the situations allowed for revaluation of the business model as it is in IFRS 9, this won't apply automatically to here. That's why, and that was my reading, that's why we do need to fine-tune here and leave it clear that it's an exception to this particular situation. So I think it's absolutely necessary, because the application guidance won't take us to this situation.
I agree with what you're saying. I think it's not necessarily an exception. It's an altogether different thing compared to a change in the business model. Yeah. It's a different, completely different story. And maybe we just need to make it clearer that this has nothing to do with a change in business model. It is a reassessment of the business model based on different set of facts and circumstances.
And just one additional aspect is that we are doing this in this standard, to be very clear. We are not changing IFRS 9. And then this will help us to have this very clear that's only for this situation.
Yes, yes. It is a transition relief, which will be a part of the new insurance contract standard.
Perfect.
And only plan transition.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think its ultimate location will help people understand that it's a different thing, because it's nothing to do with reclassifications, and we shouldn't even be analogizing to that, really. It's as if you hadn't applied 9 and you come in again. But I think it is very important that it is optional, as recommended by the staff, because I think otherwise people are going to feel like they might have to justify their old business model, which is not in the sort of spirit of what's intended here. So I think that this approach is the right approach.
I'm perfectly happy with the response given by the staff to the excellent question raised by Mary. I think the problem is the term reassessment versus change. I mean, a business model changes or doesn't change. And the fact you do a first assessment and then a second assessment, a reassessment, should not normally lead you to different conclusions if the business model has not changed. So maybe it's about the term reassessment that we, and I'm not good enough in English to find another term to describe that. But normally I assess the first time, I reassess, the same thing is here. I should not change my conclusions based on a reassessment. So I think maybe the wording, I don't have a proposal, but you could find something else to describe that when you reassess something that doesn't change, here you have a chance. You have a chance to change the conclusions, although the things that didn't change.
Well, I think you'd be able to just use the word determine.
Yes.
In the transition, because you'll only be reading it if you're in the situation when you're applying it. So I think we can deal with your.
So we can pick it up from the draft.
Somebody mentioned the term new assessment. I mean, I don't know if that's a help. When we were going through this before, but I must say I find this all very subtle. It's not a change in business model.
So
it's a new assessment of your business model. due to new circumstances, and the new circumstances are the new IFRS 4 and how you measure liability. And am I correct? And then you're trying to avoid mismatches. And
it's how you might react to the existence of the new standard, that you might do something because of it, not because the standard in itself is not the new circumstance.
I think it's going to be very clear when it's drafted, to be honest.
Now, so in what circumstances could it lead to a new business model?
The argument that people raised was that they may change the way they manage their business because of the change in insurance accounting.
That's a change of business.
Well, no, it's not in 9 speak, and I think it's best if we try and stay away from the contrast with 9, because. But it's all we're talking about is this is something somebody would do if they're starting to change their insurance accounting, and we're asking them to do that at that point in time. Just a transition question.
And also in IFRS 9, we talk specifically about a demonstrable change, such as an acquisition.
No, if I could, the point is, in IFRS 9, we prohibit people from doing this. So we're trying to say, in this one case, we're going to be kind and say you can look at it again, but only in this one case because you're transitioning to new insurance accounting. And that's the subtlety.
IFRS 9 is quite restrictive when you go to the application guidance and take it into consideration, the base for conclusion. That's why we do need to be very clear in this standard what we are doing. And that's the staff's proposal, I think.
It's not the reassessment of the business model, actually. It's not that.
The new label is unhelpful, is what I'm hearing. Yeah. So essentially, Hans, if I
can tell you, new assessment.
So if in IFRS 9, Hans.
I think a new assessment is the same as the reassessment.
Well, Hans, because words really matter in IFRS 9, so we shouldn't say that.
I think we can pick up some of this in the drafting. I think the intention seems to be clear. We're seeing that IFRS 9 has particular requirements for when and only when you can reclassify and do things, treat it as a different business model. Now, I think it also envisages that business models may change slightly in certain edges in over time, but you don't reclassify anyway. What we're seeing here is that you act as if you were applying IFRS 9 for the first time when you apply the new insurance contract standard. And that's different from if you had applied IFRS 9 and when you might be allowed to change.
And what's the rationale for
it? It's because we don't want to put... we were kind.
The rationale people gave us was that they might change the way they manage their assets simply as a result of the insurance contracts accounting.
But then that would be a change in their business model.
No, it wouldn't. I think in IFRS 9, basically a change in business model is that I buy a new company. And there's not many other circumstances, and this
really
is far more subtle.
Made it really hard in IS 9 to prevent people switching, in IFRS 9 to switch people, stop people switching back and forth.
I think that really
because of that, there is a very high hurdle. And what we've heard from insurers in some circumstances, they think the change that they enact as a consequence of adopting a new insurance standard,
which is changing the way you measure liabilities,
which is a change in the way you manage the underlying assets because of the fact that you've measured your liabilities differently, may have the consequence of them changing their business model for assets, and that they then, if they were doing the assessment as a brand new, never before done assessment, they may come to a different conclusion to what they originally came to.
Yeah. They'll manage their assets differently because of the change in the measurement of liability.
Because the information that you're presenting to the users of your financial statements is going to be different, and that does affect the way you manage some assets.
I would have thought you manage your assets in the most economically efficient manner.
I think there is.
How long have you been in accounting? This naivete of this man.
People told us that one of the reasons they wanted to apply IFRS 9 and new insurance contract standard at the same time was that would allow them best to line up their assessments and the new accounting for insurance companies contracts and everything else they might do when they're applying things for the first time. This relief allows them to assess for IFRS 9 purposes just as if they had done that. And that's the purpose of the relief.
Okay. That was a brilliant question, Mary.
See if I can repeat it. I get.
I had your chance. So now solving things or raising new questions?
I hope it's solving things. I want to ask a question of the staff about, as a consequence of applying this transition relief, is what we're really expecting that some entities, it's not so much that business model changes as the question of what proportion of their assets are in X business model versus Y business model. But, you know, I'm not saying this is what it has to be and we write up, but what do we think will happen? I'm inferring from some of the remarks that there's some stuff that's at the margin about whether you consider it to be part of X business model that's managing it to hold to collect and hold to sell, might move it the other way back and forth. So it isn't that the business models that they have for managing are fundamentally going to change, but it might be which assets are kind of within that business model. And it's this kind of transfer that we don't permit under IFRS 9 that people may be reassessing when they adopt, you know, different liability measurement requirements, because they could get maybe more reflection of economic hedging in their accounting. So is it this kind of shifting
really
between?
Good.
I think it depends on the circumstances of each individual company. I think it's quite difficult to generalize, I'm afraid.
Okay, so we don't know this.
Okay, can we round this up? So I'm kind of hoping I'm making this
better.
Nervous about going into this, but I think the way I thought about it simply is that nothing here suspends the reclassification requirements under 9. Those remain exactly consistent. There's no optionality. If you have triggered the reclassification in 9, you have to reclassify. What this does is allows a restart, in that I can rethink the facts that I've got and see if I come to a different conclusion. And that means that we've decreased the hurdle.
So
I think it's a one-off restart. But because a restart would imply doing the whole adoption of IFRS 9 again, we make it optional, because for many insurers, and this comes to Ian's point, for many insurers there is going to be no difference. So it would be very onerous to go through that whole process.
Okay.
That'll...
So based on these, Mary's excellent comment, question, your explanation, I'm in a puzzle with that. In the case, if you are allowed to change your business model, their previous decision...
You're not.
Yeah, that's based on some fact and circumstances.
Like a new assessment.
So, new assessment. The prior decision, is it right accounting or it's a kind of fraud?
They can only change the business model if there's a change in facts and circumstances.
Yep. I'm saying, you know, in the practical world, Daryl, Daryl has said, you know, accounting firms and managers, they decided that this is a business model A, so they classify all their financial letters, so on. But after this relief, business, you know, they reassess the business model. So coincidentally, they have to change their business model B. In that case, is there any liable for managers, the audit firms, to make a decision on this previous classification based on business?
It's a different set of facts and circumstances. If nothing's changed, it won't be a different conclusion. If something's changed, it could be a different conclusion.
But I think also, Chungwu, if somebody does conclude that something different when you do this assessment as if you were doing it for the first time, that would not imply that it was an error before.
Right.
There's no implication. That's what you were asking.
I'm asking. No, I don't think that'll be the case. But mechanically, you know, if I just follow this approach, reassessment of business model based on your comments.
I don't think so. I think that's what Daryl explained why it would not be.
I think
the problem is in the practitioners.
I think that they'll need to show their auditors that what the change has been that causes them to come to a different conclusion.
Yes.
Which is why I'll show my hand in advance. I think it's important that we have the disclosures that explain that.
Daryl, can I say another way? To some extent, similar to the estimation of hedging relationship, because of the new hedging standards.
So essentially what you're saying is that our standards, you're required to designate a hedging relationship and then stick with it through life. What we would say is on transition, we might have said, well, you can either stick with it
or this one occasion you're allowed to revisit and see whether or not you think it's all valid. Well, I think it's I don't think it's exactly the same, but I think it's a similar type of thing.
Okay, I sense that we can agree with the staff's recommendation.
Yes.
Everyone,
all in favour? All agree.
Moving to question three, the application of all transition reliefs for classification measurement of financial assets. The 2013 exposure draft insurance contract proposed that redesignation of financial assets under the fair value option and the OCI presentation election for investments in equity instruments should be made based on facts and circumstances at the beginning of the earliest period presented. In January 2015, the ISB tentatively decided, subject to further discussion, that the reassessment of business model for financial assets should be based on facts and circumstances on initial application of the new insurance contract standard, that at the beginning of the latest period presented. We think that all transition reliefs should be assessed based on facts and circumstances as of the same date, and we think that the date of initial application of the new insurance contract standard is appropriate, that is the beginning of the current or the latest reporting period. And this is because, in particular, we think it would be difficult for an entity to assess its business model based on facts and circumstances that existed in the past, particularly without the use of hindsight. And in addition, we think it's also most appropriate to reflect current facts and circumstances. So we think the assessment should be made at the beginning of the latest period presented. And we think that that assessment should then be applied retrospectively as an adjustment to the opening balance of retained earnings or accumulated other comprehensive income. I would like to also point out that Agenda Paper 2A does not discuss presentation of comparative information, and therefore in this paper we do not discuss which the opening balance of which period is adjusted. Comparative information is discussed in Agenda Paper 2B, which is next for the discussion at this meeting. The staff recommendation is set out in paragraphs 34 and 35. Do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Sure.
Yes, I do. And when I was reading this paper, I thought of another reason why I think it's important, which is that if the argument that people are raising is that the way that they actually manage their assets is going to change as a result of the new insurance contracts accounting, and that's one of the reasons why they want to be able to reassess, as Mary rightly said, that's based on an assessment of facts, so things like what's your business plan, what are you actually planning to do with these assets, how are you going to manage them. And presumably that can't be something that you could say a year ago I would have done it differently because of insurance contracts accounting. It needs to be something that's forward-looking. So part of one of the really important pieces of facts and circumstances that you should be considering is what your new plans are given insurance contracts accounting. So that must be, I would have thought, at the date of applying it, so at the beginning of the current period.
That makes sense. During assessment.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on to disclosure requirements. So we know that under the overlay approach, the ISB decided to require entities to disclose its policy for designating financial assets as related to insurance contracts. And we believe that the same disclosure requirement would equally provide useful information for the new assessment of the business model. We also know that the ISB has already set out disclosure requirements in IFRS 7, which deal with changes in classification and measurement of financial assets on transition from either IAS 39 to IFRS 9 or on transition from an earlier version of IFRS 9 to a later version of IFRS 9. And those disclosure requirements in IFRS 7 are designed to provide qualitative and quantitative information to users of financial statements about such changes in classifications. We think that the same disclosure requirements are equally appropriate and would provide useful information for any changes in classification and measurement of financial assets as a result of the transition to the new insurance contract standard. The disclosure requirements recommended by the staff are set out in paragraphs 36 and 39 of Agenda Paper 2A. Do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Mm-hmm.
And it is, entity should say an explanation why it came to a different conclusion in this restart. I find it difficult because it is really not, as we have now discussed for some minutes, it's not a change in business model. We all know it is maybe on the fact and circumstances because a new accounting standard comes into place. And other than saying that, I don't know what a company should do. And therefore, I think if you require this why, I think it will end in boilerplate disclosure, and I don't see the reason why an entity, and what an entity should say, other than, okay, ISB has allowed me this restart, and now a new insurance standard coming into play, and therefore I reassess some of my assets. That's it. I don't know what additional explanation an entity should give.
Better than not saying anything.
I think that is for me that is boilerplate, and therefore I think it is not necessary.
I think it's actually important that we ask people to explain why, because I think it will reinforce the message that this isn't just a choice, this is because something is different. And what I would be hoping they would say in response to this is, relative to when I first made the assessment, the following facts and circumstances change because of the new insurance contracts accounting. I'm going to manage my assets, blah, 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 as opposed to whatever it was before. And that causes me to consider that they are held to collect and sell rather than held to collect or whatever it is. And that would be what I would be getting at, because I think otherwise it might create a perception that it is a free choice, and that is not how IFRS 9 is designed. We take the business model assessment seriously as an assessment of facts and circumstances, and I think this will help us with ensuring there's been discipline around the process.
Daryl? I would agree with everything Sue said, and I think Ian's earlier concerns about why we have these differences was an exact illustration of the fact, and I think realistically the change in accounting standards in and of itself is not enough to actually give effect to this. We don't simply say because there's a new accounting standard you can change business models. You need to point to the fact that as a consequence of that, you have chosen to reward staff differently, measure staff performance differently, allow for more sales or less sales, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there has to be a real driver, and I think we need to have it
what
here.
What does the rewards to staff have to do with
this? It's one of the tests we've included in IFRS 9 that you need to consider to decide how your business model is run.
But here, it doesn't apply here. You don't have to have that to do
it. The point
it could
being
be a relevant new fact.
You don't have to.
But you need to consider all your facts and circumstances, and there needs to be a change in
them. If the only fact and circumstances, as Martin said, is a change in accounting standard, that's the only thing I have.
Not a change in business model.
Then you can't change
I can't do a reassessment.
But you're not changing it, you're reassessing it.
But you don't have a change in business model, but we're giving this relief.
No,
that is what we said. And now saying, okay, but you should give us an explanation of what is the change in business model.
If at the time the assessment is the same. You need to have new facts and circumstances.
I think essentially what you're saying here is you're gonna have the change in accounting standards. That does nothing, and that doesn't by any manner it doesn't say you can reassess, reclassify, restart, whatever word you choose to use. So I think that first step means nothing has happened at this point. As a consequence of a different measurement methodology for your liabilities, you may choose to change the way you manage assets in order to get an outcome that reflects a more equivalent reporting profitability on the asset side.
Accounting mismatches. Accounting mismatches.
It may be about accounting mismatches. It may be just about it's going to be about the way you manage your assets. Though. When you think about sales decisions, et cetera, all of that will result in a change in the way you think about the assets. And only if that second criteria is met would you be allowed under this to consider the restart. Would you come to a different conclusion in applying the business model test? And I think that second fact is going to happen far less often. And so you want some kind of explanation as to
But Daryl, that is my point. If somebody is doing that, what you have said is a disclosure for all kind of entities, nothing else. And that is my point. Why do we require this disclosure?
Can I answer that question?
I think we should require, that is what we are doing, a kind of the quantitative impact, what has changed. That is a meaningful disclosure.
Right.
But that is but why? For me, it's not meaningful.
I think it has implications for the earnings that are reported for that period. So I would like to know, as an analyst, what the earnings would be under the old measurement approach and what the earnings are under the new measurement. Now, they're not going to give you that directly, but I can figure that out from the information in A, B, and C, just as I did in 2008 when the ISB changed its reclassification rules and as the FASB changed its reclassification rules. And in some cases, the effects on earnings were very, very material. Mm. So there is value in this. As Daryl just pointed out, you're getting a qualitative and quantitative sense as to the profitability of the company in that period of time. So it's useful.
Philippe?
I'm getting a bit confused. We just voted to give a transition relief, and we did not put any conditions except that would be disclosures. We said the fact you have a new accounting standard gives you permission, even if there is no change in business model according to IFRS 9.
That wasn't what we said. That was not what we voted on.
We voted what exactly?
To assess the business model as at the date you start applying insurance.
Exactly.
And you need to assess it based on facts and circumstances.
If the facts and circumstances are exactly the same, then you get the same conclusion.
This is very vague. We did not specify at that time which facts and circumstances. And to me, there was an understanding that applying the new IFRS 4 phase 2 was sufficient, absent any change in business model, to have a new look at the classification of measurement. Now, through disclosures, we seem to be introducing conditions that were not specified when we voted 5 minutes ago. And now I'm a bit confused, because if we want to have conditions, I think we have to be very specific in the standard when we talk about the transition relief, not the disclosures.
Philippe, I disagree. The interchange that I had with Ian and Hans, where Hans specifically pointed out that Ian might be naive. Essentially what that was about, so that sort of stuck in my mind. That interchange was precisely about the point that the change in accounting standards is not enough. You're looking to see that change in accounting standards had an impact on the way, on the business model that you apply
Let
to your assets.
Let me ask you the question more bluntly. The fact that you have a new mismatch between your previous asset classification and your new measurement of liabilities, does that trigger, according to the relief, the permission to reclassify?
We already allow you to exercise the fair value option at the changeover point as part of the transition.
Assume I have not opted for the fair value option on my first application of IFRS 9 or to my liabilities, right? So I find myself in a situation where now, because of IFRS 4, phase 2, I have a new mismatch at that point.
Right. But we also have given an IFRS in this transition relief package, a separate, you get to redo the fair value option and fair value OCI as another, that's another bit. So you've gotten to redo those also.
But again, it's based on the IFRS 9 for saying I can apply the fair value option if I meet whatever IFRS 9 says. So when we ask for you to look at the new financial, well, the old financial assets and assess the business model again, we're still saying go to IFRS 9. What does IFRS 9 say? Is your business model according to those facts and circumstances.
But do it from today.
But do it
not
from today.
Not from 3 years ago or...
Look at IFRS 9. Look at what you're doing today. Would you... What is your business model?
Business model is the same as the day before.
Then it's the same. But if you do genuinely change, as Daryl was
even
saying,
even if you don't meet the reclass threshold, if it's changed, even though you don't meet the reclass threshold, you might come to a different conclusion.
Yeah.
It's like an activation energy.
Yeah, if you find it's clear, fine.
And it's the same, the transition release are the same as if you gave an IFRS 9, is you apply this business model, if I'm correct, at the date you apply IFRS 9, not... You know, the assets were started a while back. You don't look at the business model of the assets that were started a while back. It's based on the facts and circumstances when you apply IFRS 9. It's exactly that same transition relief.
So if the business model has no change or is no transition relief?
Yes, but you have to look at the facts.
It's not what I understood from the previous discussion.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that all of that understood, can we
So one against,
13
15
in favor, one against.
Yeah. Now that you must put them in a good mood, it's really nice.
Thank you.
Speak slowly.
She'll just go straight to the question.
So now let's move on to agenda paper 2B, which deals with the restatement of comparative information on initial application of the new insurance contract standard. We are dealing with this question because the ISB has reached different conclusions on restatement of prior period comparative information in its in IFRS 9 and its in its deliberations on the new insurance contract standards. IFRS 9 does not require entities to restate comparative information. It permits them to do so only if it is possible without hindsight. And additionally, the entity must provide disclosures to explain the effect of the transition from IS 39 to IFRS 9 on initial application of IFRS 9. On the other side, the 2013 exposure draft on insurance contracts proposed that where practicable, entities should apply the proposed new standards retrospectively. If it is impracticable, it proposed a simplified approach that would approximate this retrospective application. And for this reason, it proposed that entities should present comparative information for all periods presented. So, to assess the interactions of those requirements in IFRS 9 and in the new insurance contract standards, we looked at two situations. The first one is when an entity initially applies IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standards at the same time. This situation could happen when an entity applies the deferral approach, which will be proposed in the forthcoming exposure draft, or if an entity chooses to apply the new insurance contract standards early. And in this situation, what will happen is that entities would restate comparative information about insurance contracts as it is required in the proposed standards, but they would not necessarily restate comparative information about related financial assets. They could choose to do so, but only if it's possible without the use of hindsight. And so in this case, it can be argued that this could distort users' understanding of those entities' financial position and performance both in the current and previous periods. So to address this, we are not proposing to make any changes to IFRS 9. So what we think the ISB could consider are two alternatives. Alternative A is to adjust the proposed approach to comparatives in the new insurance contract standards so that it requires a restatement of comparative information about insurance contracts only if an entity restates comparative information under IFRS 9. And in addition to that, the ISB could ask for disclosure of comparative information in the notes to the financial statement. And alternative B is to continue to keep the existing requirement in the proposed that was proposed in the 2013 ED, that is to require all entities to restate comparative information about insurance contracts. And the paper lists advantages and disadvantages of these approaches. And what we think the question is to balance the more visible presentation of comparative information about insurance contracts or against the disadvantages of non-aligned accounting for financial assets and insurance contracts in the comparative period. We think that non-provision of comparative information about insurance contracts in the financial statements would reduce the usefulness of those financial statements on the first application of the new insurance contract standards. And it would also contradict the general principle of ISH, which requires restatement of comparative periods unless it is impracticable. For this reason, the staff recommend to retain the requirement to restate comparative information in the new insurance contract standards for all entities. And question one asks you whether you agree with this decision.
We do?
Yep.
All in favor?
Patrick?
Matt? Grudgingly, yes.
Gary's not here.
Gary's just left.
All right. So the next situation is when IFRS 9 is applied before the new insurance contract standard. And this would be the case for entities that do not apply the deferral approach and do not apply the new insurance contract standard early. In this case, entities would apply IFRS 9 for at least 2 years before they need to apply the new insurance contract standard. And as a result,
the prior periods in the financial statement of those entities will reflect IFRS 9 because they have already been applying it and will also have comparative information about insurance contract standards. But you've just agreed to provide transition relief to designate and designate financial assets under fair value option and OCR presentation for investment in equity instruments, and to determine the new business model for managing financial assets. So now, if entities choose to apply this transition relief, the question is whether you would like them to restate comparative information about reclassified financial assets. So we think that requirements for comparatives in this case should be consistent with and should not create disadvantage compared to those requirements that are applied on initial application of the of IFRS 9, and also requirements applied by entities that apply IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standard at the same time. And as you decided earlier, the new reclassification would be based on facts and circumstances that exist at the date of initial application of the insurance contract standard, and that classification will be applied retrospectively, and this is consistent with transition provisions for IFRS 9. Also, as noted earlier, IFRS 9 permits but does not require restatement of comparative information, and these requirements will be applied at initial application of IFRS 9 and also by those entities that apply the new insurance contract standard and IFRS 9 at the same time. So we think that the same provisions should be applied by entities who apply transition reliefs on the initial application of the new insurance contract standards. So we think that these entities should be permitted but not required to restate comparative information about financial assets, and they should be able to do so only if it is possible without the use of hindsight. So question two asks whether you agree with this recommendation.
I do, but given the fact that we just voted for a set of disclosures on the effect of the redetermination of the assets before and after and the effect, etc. So on that basis, I think already a good deal of information is provided on that effect. So to require a prior reassessment or redetermination at an earlier period will not add much.
Mary?
I wanted to ask staff why we thought that the permission, I agree permission not requirement to restate comparatives, and I agree that the permission not requirement should be consistent with the permission not requirement in IFRS 9 itself for the original adoption, but why you believe that it is the permission should be conditional on having used the transition release as opposed to being an unconstrained permission, am I misunderstanding something? Because when I read question two, I can see that if you restate the comparatives, I would expect you to do the comparatives consistent with the transition reliefs you elected. But I read it as being conditional upon.
But here we are only talking about those entities that apply these transition reliefs. If they do not apply those transition reliefs, they already have comparative information under IFRS 9 because they've been applying it for 2 years already.
Steve.
Yes, of course. Okay, thanks.
I agree with everything you've got here. I just wanted to ask about this hindsight part of it. So what actually could cause a problem there? And could it ever be unavoidable, particularly with a bit of forward planning? It seems to me that if you plan for the transition appropriately, you can avoid the problem of hindsight.
Yeah.
Am I right in that? So therefore, this won't, in practice, create a barrier to restating comparatives.
So if you have contemporaneous information as we use in another standard, I think, then that's not hindsight. That's what you're asking, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I mean by planning.
Yeah.
Historically, it was because of the problem of people working out expected credit losses in hindsight and old EIRs when they didn't have them before. I think you're right, though. If they sort of know this is coming, then maybe they can collect the information earlier.
Yeah, but even with that, because most of the change is going to be from cost to fair value OCR, fair value OCR to P&L, because you're moving in that direction, then you won't have a problem anyway.
So I think it might be less of a barrier in practice, if that's what your question is.
Yeah.
Okay, do we have a statute of recommendation?
All in favour, I think.
We're now moving on to paper 2C. We staff ask the board if the new insurance contract standard should retain the mirroring approach to the measurement and presentation of the contracts that were proposed in the 2013 ED. Paragraphs 4 to 14, the staff describe the mirroring approach and the views received as expressed in the comment letters. In general, mirroring was not well received. For example, constituents were concerned about complexity arising from the bifurcation of cash flows and inconsistency in the measurement of fulfilment cash flows depending on the measurement basis of underlying items. However, some constituents were in favour of mirroring for mutual entities. In paragraphs 15 to 23, the staff explain why mutual entities may support mirroring. The mirroring approach eliminates accounting mismatches between liabilities and underlying items to the extent that an entity expects to settle its liabilities with the underlying items that it holds. Accounting mismatches can arise in the statement of financial position of proprietary and mutual insurers if fulfilment cash flows are based on the fair value of underlying items held, but the items themselves are not measured at fair value. However, the effect of accounting mismatches on mutual insurers is potentially greater than for proprietary companies because mutuals would not normally have equity, which can cause them to report liabilities that are greater than recognised assets if those assets are measured at amounts less than fair value. Proprietary companies, there's not normally such a problem for them because they have equity that could absorb this effect. As noted in paragraphs 24 to 28, the staff do not propose that mirroring should be retained in the new insurance contract standard. The ISB's general principle is that economically similar products should be accounted for in a similar way, regardless of the legal form of the entity holding or issuing the product. The staff place greater weight on this principle than the potential effect of accounting mismatches on the reported financial position of mutual insurers. Paragraphs 29 to 31 of the paper, the staff illustrate how mutual insurers can adapt the presentation of their financial statements consistent with the principles of IS1 to help users to understand their financial position and the different nature of liabilities to policyholders in their capacity as policyholders and also as owners of the entity. The policyholder-owner split shown in the paper is one of several potential ways in which liabilities could be presented. For example, mutual insurers could instead present such separate liabilities in respect of current and future policyholders. Paragraph 32, the staff asks the board if it agrees that the mirroring approach proposed in the 2013 ED should not be permitted or required in the proposed insurance contract standard. And after that, Robert, I now like to turn it over to the board for discussion.
Yeah. I agree with the proposal, and I agree with removing mirroring, and also I agree with providing such a style of presentation. That's fine. But however, we must be very careful not to mislead that no insurance, no mutual insurance can have equity. I mean, there are many insurance companies who seems to have equity, even though mutual style of cooperate. They have
mutualized.
Yeah. Actually, they have substantially equity. So therefore, we should be very careful that ISB is saying that mutual company cannot have equity. So that's a very important point because most mutual companies, mutual insurer, have a reserve for the future policy holders. but you know, they are unknown future policy holders. Maybe future policy holder in 20 years' time. And most important point is those companies are based on the operating based on going concern. So unless they liquidate, they are not obliged to pay out their reserve to the policyholder. So then that meets the alpha approach in the our FIS project. Yeah, and also so that maybe if mutual company were to pay to the policyholder, then it depends on the resources of the entity. Then it meets beta as well. So then in this sense, there are many mutual industry who has a substantial equity. And also those equity may have what we call orphaned surplus. So it was caused by the policyholder long time ago. And that those policyholders do not have a right anymore. And also, when mutual company demutualize, then in normal practice, we recognize such kind of surplus as an equity at the beginning of demutualized company. So that they issue the equity notes based on those surpluses. So therefore, actually, they are not obliged to pay, so it's not liability. So therefore, there are lots of discussion which we have to make about the presentation of the mutual, and we haven't discussed it. And I don't think we have to discuss it in the insurance contract project. But one thing I'm very much concerned with this month's paper is it can be misunderstood as if the IFRS is saying, ISB is saying that no mutual company can have equity. That is not our intention.
I agree with the proposals and just explained. I can see Tuck's point. I don't think we need to get into the debate as to whether there's equity
that's
or not.
That's not what
and
I'm
so
saying.
So we don't need to state that there is no equity necessarily. You know, the presentation thing, we've been in the UK, we had this presentation solution for legal partnerships and all sorts of people who apparently didn't have equity either. So, I mean, I totally agree, we don't need mirroring to cover this, that presentation, if there is no equity. We don't need to enter into the argument about whether there is or not. Yeah, we could handle it and just leave it at that.
Beryl. So I think, again, both Ian and Tuck's comments are very valid, and I think your last sentence of paragraph 16 reflects exactly that, where it says there should normally be no equity remaining. Absolutely. At the same time, I think I would be slightly nervous about the two examples that Tuck used.
Yeah.
The first example Tuck used was the fact that I have got a liability that I'm not compelled to pay out to policyholders. Now, essentially, the entirety of the insurance model at this point recognizes that some insurance payments are discretionary. There is no obligation to pay them,
mm-hmm.
but there is an expectation to pay them. Yeah. And I think in my experience, although many mutuals don't have an obligation to pay something out to their policyholders.
Yeah.
There is an expectation that they will pay it out to the policyholders. Our principle in insurance goes a little bit further to also say it's not just the current policyholders, but also future policyholders. And so while I think that there are some circumstances where mutuals genuinely can keep the money and give it to charity if they want to, my understanding is that most mutuals still have an obligation eventually to give that money to policyholders. I think that becomes important. I think demutualization is an event in which essentially it's a legal construct by which the mutual chooses to give that money to their policyholders. It's simply a different mechanism by which they've actually given it to the policyholders. So I think those two examples I'm slightly concerned about as examples of why there's equity, mm-hmm. to my mind, are in fact examples of why there's a liability. But I still think there will be some, and I agree with Ian, that we really don't want to get into that debate in this project.
Yes.
Stephen.
I with everything Daryl says, and I agree with all your recommendations. It's part of the problem that when people use the term mutuals, they have something different in mind. Because I think that some companies which have shareholders, people start to talk about them as being mutuals because, well, they have these policies, but they also have a more residual claim, which is the equity investor. In that situation, clearly you do have equity, because there is not the expectation that you're going to pay everything out to those policyholders. There is some mechanism to determine how much they get and what's left for the shareholders.
That could be. In the comment letters from the 2013, we also received letters from people who said, yeah, I totally agree. If you've got policyholders who have the rights on the surplus, then it's got no equity. But we've got contracts, we've got companies with no policyholders with that sort of right. So it's not as if all mutuals are the same.
Yeah. And I think all those arguments is exactly why we don't want to come up with special requirements for mutuals.
I agree.
Can I ask a question?
John Wood,
go ahead.
Sorry, just a short question on that presentation. Mm-hmm. Is it the new line item is a kind of a non-IFRS item?
No.
For example, if you see page, paragraph 30, there is a state of financial position. The last item, equity interest attributable to policyholder in the capacity at owners. So if you put 5 and 7, then it makes negative equity become zero equity, right?
Yes.
So to resolve the negative equity issue, we have added this last line item. So I'm saying this last line item is inconsistent with our IFRS, or this is some other non-IFRS item.
No.
Well, IFRS says that ISO 1 gives quite a lot of flexibility in how line items are presented and how things should be described or split apart. We don't have given labels for particular line items, and we ask that people use what's useful to their users in explaining it, so it's entirely consistent with that principle.
So what you have just explained to me is it consistent with IFRS?
Well, ISO 1. I think at the end of the day, all we're emphasizing is there are different ways of presenting. Our intention is not to have this in the standard. We're just showing that there are different ways of presenting. Mm-hmm. But again, you cannot label something as equity if it's not equity. That's very clear.
Yes. Actually, I'd like to pick up on that exact last phrase that Joanna used.
Yes.
Can you label something as a liability which isn't a liability? So
according to the conceptual framework, you can.
actually, that was my next observation. Is there a present obligation of the reporting entity to transfer resources to the policyholders in the second class, this line item here? So maybe we're debating words, just the nomenclature. The only point I'm really trying to make here is that perhaps this presentation should be driven or governed by the laws in which the legal entity operates.
Yeah.
That's kind of an overlay, and I'm not quite sure we can necessarily say definitively that a mutual insurance company, as Tak just mentioned, never has surplus. Because there might be a rule that says, even though ultimately it'll all be distributed as you are operating until you get to liquidation, right? There's an amount that has to be held back. So in fact, is it a liability in their capacity as owners? I don't know. Meaning, are there really any owners? So that's my question here. Maybe there are no owners.
But remember,
so maybe it's just surplus, undistributed policyholder.
It could have that. But remember that the existence of a contract that requires payments,
mm-hmm.
even however far in the future, regardless of what restrictions might be on that, is still a present obligation.
Yes.
And so that would still meet the definition of the liability. And the insurance contracts model that we're developing defines how one measures that liability. So I think there is a liability.
I don't disagree with that. All I'm saying is if the jurisdiction requires a certain amount of those assets that aren't permitted to be used for that purpose that you just described, i.e. guaranteed benefits and maybe a dividend, then perhaps maybe there is a surplus in the entity.
Yeah. There could be.
That's,
but equally,
that's
just because that the regulation says you can't pay that out doesn't mean that there isn't a liability.
I guess, I think Pat's point is you could disaggregate the liability. You could say this is a surplus that cannot be distributed to the current generation.
That's right.
Generation.
Oh,
you
it's a non-current
you know, or yeah, this
yeah,
surplus
very,
is for future.
Right.
According to my solvency rules.
Right, exactly.
Yes,
yeah.
You could do that. You could disaggregate the liability, absolutely.
But I think, Andrea, that there's one slight difference, or major difference, that is the surplus will not be measured based on new standards.
Is there a surplus, I think, was
if,
what I was asking.
Because it is residual.
If it, if
no,
it
we,
is
no, the Tucker and the Darrow, I think, discussed different things. Darrow said that based on new standards, you will... You know, recognize some liabilities, even though it is not, you know, you have to based on the expectations. But Tata said, you know, even with this,
yes.
There is still remaining part
yeah.
that will be residual.
Yeah.
And that part will not be measured based on new standards.
And I think that's
so there's a major difference.
That's the same thing Patrick
okay,
is
yeah.
saying.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, that's
some
right.
legislative
different.
Environments, there may genuinely be something that is kind of left behind for nobody.
Yeah.
Really.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is
yeah.
a major difference.
But I think that's more the exception than the
yeah.
rule.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I assume we can agree with the staff's recommendation.
All agree?
Great job.
Okay.
It's a.
Okay. So let's move to the last paper on the two series. It's going to be agenda paper 2D. That paper discusses presentation and disclosures for insurance contracts. I would like to note that in 2013 exposure draft, we didn't ask any specific questions about disclosures, but we did receive some comments, and we actually dealt with those comments already in April 2014. So in this paper, we did not specifically refer back to those comments other than Appendix A. So the scope of this paper was only about focusing about implication of our decisions since 2013 exposure draft to just check if there are any presentation or disclosure requirements that we might want to add or maybe subtract from what we used to have. So those decisions were variable fee approach and the changes to OCI proposals that we have done recently in September. And also there was a publication of IFRS 15 since we published our previous exposure draft. So we did focus on making sure that there is a consistency between our standards. In addition, we have been thinking about the package of disclosures overall. We had some comments from users. We just were trying to make sure that we did address those comments. And then we had an overall concerns from preparers about the disclosure overload. So we're trying to think about it and take it on board and analyze it in this paper. So what I'm planning to do today is discuss questions and they as they are in the paper, in the order that they are in the paper, and I'm planning to discuss it separately. So I'll start with the presentation. So in terms of the presentation, we have started with IAS 1, because that prescribes the basis for preparation of the general purpose financial statements to ensure comparability. In the 2013 exposure draft, we already amended, well, proposed to amend IAS 1, and we said that whenever we list some items, then we might consider specific items for insurance contract. So in the list of items to be presented on the in the statement of financial position, we did propose to include insurance contracts and reinsurance contracts. We have also proposed to include line items specific for gains and losses for insurance contracts to be presented in other comprehensive income as a separate line item. We didn't amend IAS 1 in relation to profit or loss statement because it already requires revenue and finance costs, so we didn't feel that there is a specific need of including anything else. So in this paper, we have been considering whether we should present any separate line item and whether we should require those separate line items related to contracts measured using the variable fee approach. The staff did not recommend requiring those separate line items because we thought that those contracts are insurance contracts, they are within the scope of our standards, so we thought that we shouldn't require to separately present them, so an entity should be allowed to present together. But also IAS-1 does not forbid to actually show them separately, so if there is a if those contracts have a different nature or different function, or they are just useful to be presented to understand the statement of financial position, an entity can do so. Also in September 2015, we had a discussion about, or actually a decision, to provide an option for an entity to recognize changes in the guarantee in the profit or loss instead of the contractual service margin. And the solution was provided to minimize accounting mismatch when an entity has derivative that is minimizing the economic risk. Now, for those contracts, the contractual service margin will be different comparing to those contracts that would not use this option. So in this paper, we have recommended to provide disclosure of the contractual service margin with and without that adjustment. Now, there was also a discussion whether we should present it separately on the face, and we were using experience from the hedge accounting when we proposed a separate presentation, but then we ended up just disclosing the amount of the adjustment because constituents believe that it would just add to the clutter of the amounts being being presented on the face of financial statement. So I would like to now go back to the question to the board. It's on page 9. And it's asking whether the IASB agreed to confirm the 2013 exposure draft proposals related to presentation of line items relating to insurance contracts in the financial statements, and then to require an entity that measures contracts using the variable fee approach and recognizes changes in the guarantee in profit or loss to disclose the amount of the contractual service margin with and without the cumulative amount of the guarantee recognized in the profit or loss. Do you agree with that recommendation, or maybe do you have any questions?
We go.
Paragraph 10, you know, when we developed 2013 EB, expressed my different views on this. That is, whether any changes or new requirement in a particular standard should trigger the consequential amendment to IAS-1 or segmental reporting or interim reports. My personal view is always it is not necessary, because you know the IAS-1 8, you know, the interim standard, interim report standards, and the segmental reporting standards is set general principles about presentation of basic financial statement, interim statement, and segmental reporting. You know, I would not feel so necessary, you know, to have consequential amendments because of particular standard changes. You know, to do so will make those four general standards quite piecemeal. You will look at the IAS-1 or interim standards or others, some very, very specific, very, you know, the unique items which is only related to a particular standards, which already there in a particular standards. Therefore, I don't think it's necessary to have such a consequential amendment.
Also a question about paragraph 10, but a different one. That I just noticed a bit of breakage between the drafting in paragraph 10 and the drafting of what's in the ED. If you look on page 23, the paragraph 54, the ED drafting that's reproduced here talks about carrying amount of portfolios, while paragraph 10 talks about contracts. And I think contracts aligns better. So the footnote I have to my agreement, you know, with the staff recommendation in response to question one is, yes, but I, and this may be drafting, but I just want to say that I am thinking about this as contract information rather than portfolio for the presentation.
So I think I didn't intend to propose a drafting or anything like it, and we will address because this is not the question or the decision for this meeting, we will address any previous decision in the drafting.
Okay. Can I ask response for them?
Mm-hmm.
IS-1.
So IS-1 already says things like property, the line item should present the following amounts: property, plant, and equipment, which is specific to IS-16, investment property, which is specific to IS-40, intangibles, which is specific to another standard, IS-38, agricultural assets, which are specific to IS-41. So it's what it's the whole structure of IS-1.
I thought historically the board had decided that where there were specific presentation things, they were needed to go in IS-1.
It's useful for people picking up
the department. I think it also creates a conflict between the standards as well, because of the way IS-1 is drafted. So you'd have to put an exception in IS-1.
Yeah. So either way, we're going to have to amend IS-1.
I've got two questions. One is, I suppose it's on question 1A loosely, but I think it's important that where we are changing CSM in response to changes in fulfillment value, so where we have unlocking, variable fee guarantees, that is really transparent and you can see the effect on those two. I'm not sure that has to be on the face of the P&L, but I presume somebody could show that on the face of the P&L, but I think it has to be somewhere. So can you confirm that is going to be visible somewhere in the disclosures?
So in the disclosure, I'm actually proposing to add the requirement of the amounts that are unlocking the contractual service margin, because that's what users specifically asked us to do as a response to unlocking decisions.
Okay. And then on B, I also think that where we would have unlocked but were now not because of the hedging, that should be transparent as well, particularly because it's going to be optional. But then you've got this, disclose the amount of the CSM with and without the cumulative amount of the guarantee recognized in profit and loss. And it strikes me that we're then maintaining two CSMs. And firstly, that could be confusing for an investor, well, which is the right CSM?
Mm-hmm.
And also, presumably, then you're going to have two disclosures showing two unlockings, two CSM allocations in order to do that second roll forward. So I wonder whether the having two CSMs is overkill in this, and that really we need to be transparent about what the adjustments are rather than maintaining a dual system and having two CSM roll forwards.
I do take your point. I think that will be an additional complication. I think the complication would be not about unlocking, because that amount is not additionally unlocked, but it will be an amount that would be recognized in the profit or loss. So that's the additional calculation, additional information that would need to be provided here, and also there would be the same adjustment, cumulative adjustment, that would need to be provided in the opening closing balance. I do agree that's an additional complication. The benefit that the users will get as a result of that is they wouldn't need to almost calculate themselves that amount. They will just have, this is the amount with, this is the amount without, and it will be just easy for them to compare. But I do take your point, it will be additional complication.
But is the amount without the adjustment of any use to anybody?
Without the adjustment. So let's say the contractual service margin equals 100, and now because of that change, it will be 90. So in the financial statement, we will have 90 because we would need to adjust it. Now the comparable amount is 100. So in the notes, we will have both amounts, and then we will explain the difference between them.
But then when you say comparable amount,
mm-hmm.
of course, two entities aren't going to be comparable anyway, because probably one is hedging and one isn't.
It's an optional, so even if you...
I know it's optional in the sense that you could have two entities that are hedging, and when one chooses to apply and one doesn't choose to apply, but you're not targeting it at that situation. And also there could be a situation where somebody hedges, somebody doesn't, somebody applies, somebody doesn't apply, and you're going to tell the person that does apply to reverse it and calculate another CSM, even though to try and get some comparability, but there is no comparability between the two entities because one's hedged and one hasn't hedged.
Steve, can I understand what you're suggesting, just to sort of think through what the accounting would look like? So I agree with you, maintaining two completely different CSM processes in parallel doesn't make a lot of sense, and that would seem to be unnecessarily difficult to do. But are you suggesting that essentially what you would do is have a gross CSM on the balance sheet, the year-end balance, less cumulative guarantees, gives you the net amount, and that would be the balance sheet disclosure in a single line item, and then your income statement, obviously you're going to reflect the effect of the change in guarantees in the current period, or are you suggesting losing that cumulative optional guarantee as well? So just showing the current period optional guarantee.
I hadn't thought whether it should be just the amount for the period or a cumulative.
So I think there's a lot of useful information in the cumulative effect of the optional guarantees on a portfolio, and I would have thought that simply kind of adding last year's opening closing balance to this year's change to sort of continually maintain it. So I think that side of it for me feels like it would be useful. And then I think the CSM then is essentially just the gross up before and after that simple number. So I think that does provide, and it maybe gets you past the concern about how difficult it would be to calculate two streams.
It was having two CSM amortization allocations
for
the period,
I would have thought on the balance sheet showing gross CSM minus the cumulative effect of options and guarantees gives me net CSM. And then how much did options and guarantees affect the current period, I think is the two useful elements. And I can see there being a lot of benefit in there without necessarily a lot of cost. But I think recalculating things like the amortization pattern of the CSM since inception of the contract, I'm not entirely sure what the useful information or how useful that information would be. I can see that being more.
I have to say I'm not convinced that your solution, Daryl, would work. I think a lot of the answer to this question depends on whether or not, to actually Stephen's question, would it matter and what value does it provide? Depends on your level of aggregation. So to the extent you have a portfolio where some of it is hedged and some of it isn't, as opposed to a portfolio that is entirely hedged versus a portfolio where you have nothing that's hedged. So I think that would potentially affect the outcome. I think the answer also would affect the emergence of future earnings. So to the extent the embedded guarantee is in the CSM, that affects your future profits. If now it's been removed because hedging, it's been booked in the current period, it's not part of the future earnings. So now I have a different multiple I'm going to put on the valuation of the in-force. So I'd like to think through this. I don't want to impose unnecessary disclosure, but at the same token, to answer the question, does it have value? I think it does.
Well, that's why I think that...
On the fly, I'm just not convinced that what you're saying...
I think the gross CSM is very useful because of exactly the point you're making about how much hedging has happened will differ from.
Right.
The gross CSM is telling me what kind of margin I built into this thing at inception, not thinking about hedging at all.
Right.
Then whatever the hedging adjustment is, both current period and cumulative, if that to my mind is transparent, I've then got a very clear indication of what the effect is has been of hedge accounting on this portfolio.
Agreed.
Inception to date and at the current point. I don't know if them trying to actually take the bits and pieces of it and break it out are necessarily as useful for each period.
You may be right. I just think it's difficult to assess on the fly. I thought this disclosure was actually quite complex, so I'm empathetic to the point you're making. I just think we need to think through the mechanics a little bit and then get back to the very question Stephen posed, which is, what does it actually tell you? And I think there is value in knowing whether or not there is an embedded guarantee that's contributing to profits, future profits, that's sitting in the CSM versus an embedded guarantee that isn't contributing to future profits because I've hedged it. I've taken away the upside. I went out and bought derivatives to offset that. So
following on that point, mm-hmm. then it would be the information of how much of this change in the guarantee was recognized in the profit or loss in the period.
That's right.
And then supposedly you can also say how much or the accumulated amount at the opening and closing balance, which, coming back to Daryl's points, it shouldn't be very much burdensome because it's just adding up everything that was happening in
right.
the past and just providing the reconciliation. I think that is going a bit step further because it's saying essentially that there would be some amount of the CSM amortized because of that difference, and we would require to calculate that. And I think that that is the question, whether we think that meets the benefit of doing that or not.
But is that cumulative amount meaningful when you're just adding it up?
Exactly.
Because the CSM balance is an amount minus an amortization, and you
okay.
just add up this
yeah.
adjustment,
right.
and it's
I'm
not
sure what the relationship is between
basis.
That gross and net.
So
what does that mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Without rerunning the entire CSM plus the allocations, you won't get comparable information.
That's
the issue. But then, to Pat's point, what information do you want to give that kind of hedging is going on, and there's a cumulative effect on
right.
the equity that is going on, not just the present day effect.
Because I'm
going
to make a forecast of
yeah.
the company's future value and
yeah.
earnings based on the CSM as of the balance sheet date. That has the embedded guarantee in it.
Yeah.
I'm still going to hedge into the future period. Until the end of that future period, I don't know how much has been taken out and transferred to P&L.
I would still think the cumulative information does have information value because it is telling you about the cumulative impact of a completely different decision you've made, completely unrelated to the underlying risk and dynamics of the contract. So completely unrelated to that contract, unrelated to the contractual terms and what you promised and how that performed, you have over and above that gone and done something different, which is to hedge. And this is just highlighting what that cumulative effect of the hedge process has been.
But you could just separate that cumulative effect out without necessarily adding it to the contractual service margin. If that's
I suppose you can do it both ways. You can show it as a separate item.
You could just disclose it. If Steve's concern is having this two CSMs, and the confusion that it causes there, then the easy way to solve that concern is to have just a cumulative amount
yeah.
that says this is today's, you know, amounts that were recognized in profit and loss, and previous years were X, Y, Z. The total is. Yeah.
I'm not sure it's going to be meaningful.
Ah, that's the question.
Do you think that there was a disclosure needed to identify this? Is it that you don't think there should be a disclosure, or do you think that there should be one and it's not this
well,
one?
Well, I guess I think the disclosure should be completely different, and that is the amount of the guarantee that went into the CSM rather than the guarantee that's coming out of the CSM. And it should be the guarantee in the CSM irrespective of
whether or not you hedge.
So the fair value of the future guarantee is what you think.
Yeah, I mean, because I've always thought the guarantee should be in the P&L anyway.
Yeah,
I'm approaching it from a different perspective.
But I think the difference is that we require now only for the people that are using the option to show
yeah.
what kind of optionality they chose. Now, I think what you're proposing is disclose for everyone, and I'm not sure if it would be simple for everyone to actually disclose that information.
No.
I think it's disclosed for everyone because you didn't like the decision we made to put it in the first place, which I think is a slightly different.
Wouldn't you want to know both, Steve, though? What is in there and what's coming up?
Yeah. And I mean, I think we've heard some feedback that entities can do that. Whether it's a fair value basis, I don't know. But they could have some form of disaggregation. Yeah, you met fulfillment.
I'm hoping that in the CSM roll forward, we'll get
yeah.
some sort of granularity as to what the driver is behind these things, even if we don't require individual line items.
In the roll forward.
Yeah.
I am wondering if, so I have a feeling that the cumulative amount is the amount that we are concerned about. Would we be okay to just disclose the amount that was recognized in the P&L in the period that was supposed to be in the CSM in the period? Would we be comfortable with that?
That's what I would do.
Okay. I could live with that.
So are we voting? Okay, so can we first vote 1A?
I have a question.
Oh, you're sorry. You didn't realize
I have a question on 1A about the kind of message we are giving. In consolidation, an international insurance group will aggregate and consolidate companies in different countries, different legal regimes, different types of contracts with different features. Some will be more or less participating contracts, some will be contracts without participation. And the accounting policy that will be applied to those different contracts will be appropriate to each type of contract. Some will have the CSM, some will have guarantees in the CSM, some not. So on the balance sheet, when you aggregate all those contracts which are actually measured on a different basis, which is appropriate to each type of contract, it seems to me that we are giving a message here that all insurance contracts could be presented in one line item in the statement of financial position. But there are different economics and different accounting requirements. Are not we encouraging too much aggregation here? And should not we say that when the accounting for those contracts is different, they should be disaggregated? I think the reconciliation or the information given under 1B is not really useful if you cannot tie in this information to a population of contracts which has to be highlighted somewhere. And maybe the best place is to highlight it on the face of the financial statements. Otherwise, you cannot really understand what this reconciliation applies to. There must be some form of tying or cross-index between this information and the balance sheet. So it seems to me that I know that IS1, you are in a way mitigating the assertion that one line item against IS1, saying that you may. I think I should be a bit more directive here. I would say if you are consolidating contracts in the consolidated financial statement of financial projects, which have different accounting regimes, they should be separated if there are based on materiality, of course. If there is a material population that follows a given regime and another population under a different regime, I would not like to see all those things in one line item in the balance sheet.
I think with the IS1, what we were trying to avoid is requiring to put them in the one line item. And I in my feeling was that IS1 already says that you need to consider whether separate line items might be necessary for you, and that will be based on the size, nature, or function of an item, or aggregation of similar items is such that separate presentation is relevant to an understanding of the entity's financial position.
But there I would add, in the case of insurance contracts, I would add the accounting for those contracts when it is significantly different would be, for me, a reason for segregating, not the usual type of things we use for fixed assets, etc. Because really, we may be adding in the balance sheet contracts which follow significantly different accounting regimes. And without a disaggregation, it's quite hard to understand what goes on.
The way I understood the variable fee approach is that it's not totally different model, but it's a model that is reflecting different features of those contracts. So that's why I didn't propose to require a separate line item, because I still view them as insurance contracts, and it's just some proposals that are reflecting just different features of those contracts. Not
if you have two portfolios, one to which the variable fee approach applies, another one to which it doesn't apply, is it good to show only one item in the balance sheet?
I think,
because in the P&L they will follow different regimes, you will have different line items in the P&L. They will have use of CSM to offset or not. I'm not sure to show all that in one line item, the balance sheet, would really help people understand the relationship between the P&L and the balance sheet, etc.
I think there is a question whether we want to require that or whether we want an entity to just find the answer for themselves.
Well, I think
it's
stronger
wording,
than
it's more
that.
The wording. I think the wording, the drafting is important. We should not give an encouragement to aggregate things which normally would be better if not aggregated.
But I think in IS1 it's a minimum requirement, and it also says, and it's actually stronger than as we're saying, it says an entity shall present additional line items if it's relevant to an understanding, which you're saying that is necessary for an understanding. So IS55 already requires that it's presented separately.
Yeah, but I'd like to have a discussion or maybe the basis for conclusions or somewhere that this is very important in the case of insurance contracts.
Steve.
Philip, I think you overstate the different regime, because I think there's far more similarity than perhaps meets the eye. The line items in the income statement will be the same for all the contracts. There'll be revenue, costs, there'll be investment income, and there'll be an interest expense on the liability, and it will be the same line items for all the contracts.
Yeah, but the CSM, you measure the CSM quite differently, right?
Okay, so in the balance sheet, we will have a fulfillment value, which will be entirely comparable, and we will have a CSM which will represent the as yet unrecognized expected profit on the contract. And it all has the same meaning. Now, precisely how we get to that CSM will vary depending upon the nature of the contract. And what we're trying to do is to construct a model that appropriately modifies how that CSM is determined depending upon the nature of the contract. So whilst, yes, there will be different requirements for variable fee versus this, underneath it all is essentially the same structure and there will be comparability.
But Steve, don't you think that the way that those contracts might unfold, if I can use that non-technical term, would be quite different? And so the reason why there are differences in sort of methodology, which is what Philippe is focusing on, is because of there being something different about the nature of the cash flows and the obligations.
Which will come out in the disclosures because of the...
But I think, building on the concept that's already in IAS1, if you really felt that it was necessary to an understanding of the statements to think about the nature of those and present separately, I think it would get us there anyway. So I would agree, I think, with Philippe in terms of it maybe being useful in the basis to remind people of that requirement in IAS1, and that maybe the nature of the cash flows would be something you'd need to take into account when you're applying that requirement, to try and encourage them to be thinking about that, not just to sort of glance over and think there's nothing there relevant to me.
Can we vote on 1A? 1A.
1A.
The basis for conclusions.
Yep.
13 12. And... Did you get 12? I got 13.
12.
We're going to...
not agree.
Not you, and who else not?
I just had a comment that I'd like to make.
Oh, it's just 13.
It's with respect to actually what Sue just said. I was actually approaching this initially from the standpoint of where Philippe was, but the more I've thought about it, I agree with what you're suggesting, Sue, is that what we need is an emphasis somewhere in the basis about the uniqueness of this type of reporting entity, insurance companies, to stress the need to provide that level of disaggregation. And the other point I would highlight is paragraph 70, which in the ED, which says, if disclosures provided in accordance with paragraph 73 to 95 are insufficient to meet the requirements in paragraph 69, which is a general objective, an entity shall disclose additional information. So emphasizing those two key points. The other thing I think that bears, I think, observing is that the insurance industry, for those who've had the luxury or not of following it, publishes extraordinary financial supplements of detailed information. And so I suspect those supplements will continue because people will not necessarily immediately move from, gee, I just want to look at the gap audited financial statements, you know, from where they were. And I think that information doesn't necessarily have to be prescribed as part of the audited financial statements. I think the market will drive that over time. So I'm actually, initially I thought we should be more prescriptive, but the more I think about this, I think we're striking a reasonable balance with those emphasis points that Sue is making.
Okay, we still agree with the staff recommendation.
Yeah.
So
could you reformulate question 1B as you indicated with the period specific
okay,
thing?
Okay, so that's the main entry.
She said it perfectly already.
Does the ISB agree to require that the entity that measures contracts using the variable fee approach and recognizes changes in guarantee in profit or loss disclose the amount of the contractual service margin recognized in profit or loss for the period?
The contractual service margin.
The guarantee.
The guarantee.
Disclose the amount of the guarantee recognized in profit or loss for the period.
Yes.
Agree?
14.
Great, continue.
So now let's move to disclosures. So as noted before, we didn't reconsider comments that we got on 2013 exposure draft because we did it before. So what we have focused in this paper is we considered whether any additional decision triggers any need for disclosure, and that was changes related to the interest accretion that we decided in September this year. And then there was a publication of IFRS 9/15, so we reviewed those disclosures as well. In addition, we looked at the overall comments from preparers and users. So from users, we had a paper in January that was summarized the feedback from users. And it, we did review this paper, so we're just trying to make sure that we capture all the information needs for the users. And for the preparers, we were trying to respond to the concerns of disclosure overload. There is quite a few disclosures that I have proposed to add and delete. So I'll just try to go through them in kind of packages of how I was thinking about it. So in terms of the presentation of part of the interest accretion in the OCI, the ISB tentatively decided that if an entity uses OCI to present interest accretion, amount presented in the P&L is based on the cost measure. But we decided not to specify the method to achieve this cost measure. So in the paper, the staff recommend that an entity provide an explanation of the method that an entity uses to calculate the cost information presented in profit or loss. In addition, we have decided to simplify transition for contracts with participating features if there is an if it's impracticable to use a retrospective approach to estimate the accumulated OCI for those contracts. So we have decided that an entity can assume that the accumulated OCI would equal zero, even though if we use it retrospectively, it wouldn't be zero. And also, there could be a situation that we actually have accumulated OCI for related assets to those contracts, and therefore the gains and losses in the OCI could unwind over time in the profit or loss without any related accumulated OCI being unwind for the liability side. So the staff recommended requiring an entity to designate financial assets as relating to contracts within the scope of the new insurance contracts at the date of transition, and then to disclose for those assets at the date of transition and each subsequent period a reconciliation from the opening to closing balance of the accumulated balance of OCI. So we would like to know for those assets how much of the OCI is still in the balance sheet and will be recognized in the future, and then how much of those OCI was recognized in the current period. As I was saying, we also analyzed the summary of outreach from users posted in January 2015 to check if there is any additional disclosure needs that we might not have fulfilled before. And as a consequence of that, I recommend three additional disclosure. One is the one that Steve already mentioned, changes in the fulfillment cash flows that is unlocking the margin. So there will be an explicit requirement to provide that information. There will be an explanation of when an entity expects to recognize the remaining contractual service margin in the profit or loss, which will give users the benefit of being able to try to estimate of how much profit they might recognize in might be recognized in future. And the amounts in the financial statement determine the transition using simplified approaches, both at transition and subsequently. Those amounts would not be measured using the retrospective approach, so some comparability might be not perfect here. So that's why we propose to disclose this amount, so a user could know that this cannot be fully comparable. We have also considered feedback from preparers about disclosure overload. And we have considered which disclosures could be omitted with, in the staff's view, not taking away important information from users. The way we thought about it is whenever we have some information provided somewhere else, maybe that disclosure is not that necessary. So we recommend that not to require disclosure which is reconciling revenue recognized in profit or loss in the premiums to premiums received in a period, because we believe that this information is already provided in the reconciliation of the insurance contract balances. We also propose not to require to disclose an analysis of the total interest expense between profit or loss and OCI. That was what we tentatively decided in March 2014. And we have noted already that we will have a separate line item in other comprehensive income for gains and losses related to insurance contracts, so that difference will be already displayed in the financial statement. As a result of review of IFRS 15, we have proposed one disclosure related to the information about practical expedients used when applying the standard. So now I'd like to move to question two to the board members on page 20, whether you confirm the disclosures proposed already in 2013 exposure draft with the changes as I described. I would like to also note that we have already voted on the point A, so we would not vote on it again this time.
Just in case.
just to confirm.
Thank you. Three questions. First, OCI on the asset side. I do agree that we should require to disclose the amount on the asset side, how much OCI was remain. However, is it really necessary to require subsequent amount of OCI in the subsequent years? And then my question is, if that is the case, do they have to track the exact financial instrument which was on the date of transition, or can they provide some ratio of the OCI or something? My question is, do we require them to track down the exact financial instrument which was on the day of transition?
I think the idea was that there is a missing bit of OCI for the liability. We have something for the asset.
Yeah.
That amount will be recognized in the future in profit and loss. So I thought that it is important at every period to kind of know how much is still in the balance sheet that will be recognized in the future. So
right.
Unfortunately, yes, that was the intention.
I understand. So then we require them to track down the...
Yes.
Right. Yeah, in a sense it's reasonable because it's kind of the price they have to pay to zero reset OCI. Okay, the second point is about revenue reconciliation. I think it's good to reduce the disclosure. However, I thought this reconciliation was very useful, not only for the users, but also preparers, maybe contract policyholders as well. Because the currently the premium number is well-known number. Many people understand what the premium is, and also regulator uses those premium numbers. So they are all used to the premium number, but we replace it to revenue, which is in a sense new invention. So then currently nobody knows what the revenue is all about. So then I think that the reconciliation with revenue to the premium received would provide very useful information, at least for 3-4 years. So is there any idea to allow it doing it or to require it for 3-4 years?
Okay, so coming to the background of it. So we do propose revenue, and currently some people do actually use revenue similar to the way we think about it, so it wouldn't be changed for everyone. But we also do currently, as a package of the disclosures together with the revenue, we have decided that we will require to present premiums received. That's a
yes,
specific
yeah.
disclosure need. We also have actually premiums written to be presented as a volume measure. So the only additional benefit of the disclosure is that it's organizing the information that we already provided in a different way. So it's a question whether we think that this disclosure is necessary to be required, or maybe people that would find it useful, they would just disclose it anyway, or some people would just find this information is already there because it's in the reconciliation of the insurance contract, all that information. So that's a question. I just thought that if we were trying to respond to the feedback from preparers, those were the disclosures that were easiest to take away because this information is already there, so we don't take away so much.
So we have the premium received number,
yes.
which is same as cash flow,
yes,
almost. And we have a premium written.
Yes.
And how about premium due?
We don't.
Right. Yeah. Mm. Oh, okay. Then that's the third question.
Okay.
About the expense, I'm going to talk about paragraph 34, A and B. I'm a bit confused. Which are you going to take away? You are going to take away paragraph 34B requirement. Am I correct?
Okay. So in 2014, we have proposed two disclosures related to interest expense. One was just simply saying this is the amount in the P&L, this is the amount in the OCI. If you take total, it's the total expense, and this is the amount that people are recognizing in the P&L if they don't choose the P&L option. That's the information that I'm proposing to take away, because the amount in the OCI, which is the difference between those two approaches, is already required to be presented according to our amendment to IAS-1. There is another disclosure which is actually required for all insurance contracts, that an entity will need to explain the components of the interest expense recognized, regardless whether it's in P&L or in the OCI. And I don't propose to change that requirement.
Right. So in that sense, those who chose profit loss presentation has to track down the interest rate at inception and the changes as well. Otherwise,
no. So the requirement of the interest expense disaggregation that I'm proposing to keep is just saying that you should disclose the information about interest expense using the current rate.
Yeah.
And then the interest expense the change from the opening balance in the current period. So it's not since
opening balance.
Yes,
only.
So it's not since
it's not,
it's just
not
opening
inception.
And closing balance.
Understand. It's not since inception.
Yes.
Right. So then now that I understand, how about the paragraph 34A(3)? It is only talk about the adjustment amount.
Yes, the adjustment amounts are calculated.
Yeah, so this seems to be a little bit difficult to understand, and also what is the usefulness of asking it? And some of the insurer said that in order to arrive at this amount, they think they have to track down the what is the amount. And also one other thing is the default is profit or loss, in a sense. No, nobody can say which is default.
No,
but
there is
diversity. But you know, in order to arrive at the current liability, then the current measurement is, in a sense, a basic model. So then, if they follow the current approach, then in order to get the recognition, they only need current rate. But if we require to show the difference between the OCI amount, then they need to track down. That's only my point.
So this disclosure that might need to be adjusted in the drafting, because the idea behind this disclosure is that we won't use any new information, and it was related to the amount that is going to unlock the contractual service margin, and when we use the rate at initial recognition, that will be the rate that we will require here. If an entity unlocks the CSM using a different rate, then we would need to adjust it to a different rate. So we might need to adjust it in the drafting. It will be just following the measurement.
Ah, I see.
So it's time to be clear. In the 2010 ED and the 2013 ED, the rate for the contractor service margin is the rate at inception.
Yes.
Regardless of whether you choose P&L or OCI.
Right.
The contractor service margin has always used only one rate,
yes,
which is the rate at inception. And this disclosure just follows the information they would already need to do for the measurement of the contractual service margin.
It's not new for the presentation,
yes,
for disclosure. It's needed for measurement.
I see.
Now, we did discuss it already in this round of deliberations, whether we should stick to the current or the locked-in rate. And we do intend to bring a paper, because that is a known difference between the variable fee approach and this approach. But there are consequences either way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So to be clear, it's B that was deleted.
Yes.
Yes. To take into account your question, Tuck, it's 34B.
So I agree with what you've proposed in terms of the disclosures in question two, and I just have two observations, one very high level and one minutia. And the high level one, Andrea might hit me later, but it was just an observation. When I read these disclosures, they are quite different in style to what we've done in some of our other recent projects. So if you look at the way that we've drafted the disclosures in IFRS 16 to be the new LISA standard, and in IFRS 7 with expected credit losses, we've tried to use more of an approach where we talk about provide information to enable users of financial statements to understand very specific things, not just the high level understand future cash flows, but then to drill down to different things and then talk about specific items that would help with that understanding. So in terms of the style of the drafting, so it reads less like a checklist and more like a, this is what we want you to understand and this will be the information that would assist to try and encourage people to take a step back and see whether they've met those more specific objectives or not. And I think it would be good if we could think about how we could rejig what's here in more in that style to encourage better communication. So that was the high level observation that I might get hit for. The minutiae was to do with OCI assets. If I understand correctly, and I agree with the basic idea you've got here, but if I understand correctly, it's really to do with the fact that you'll have some recycling happening because of OCI assets and you won't have a sort of counteracting effect because of the relief we've given for the liabilities. But I'm guessing that's probably true if they're OCI assets with recycling, so I'm not sure that the OCI equity instruments in IFRS 9 should be captured by this disclosure.
Yep.
Mary?
Question. When we talked, I think it was in September, that may be wrong, about the decision to permit but not require presentation of changes in discount rates on a disaggregated basis, one of the things we were balancing is the driver in the 2013 ED for showing the difference between underwriting and investing, and that was the benefit. Is there any disclosure that will give that insight, in terms of the disaggregation? Because my recollection, not having prepared this question properly, is that there are arguments both about the cost, the hassle of having to disaggregate, but also depending upon the asset portfolio and how it is managed, it might be much simpler to get what people thought would be a better presentation by just measuring, recognizing all the changes in P&L, even if that meant a loss of that separation of underwriting and investing. Is there anything that gives users of financial statements insight into underwriting versus investing for those entities that elect to present all changes in discount rate in P&L?
So the way I'm thinking about underwriting and investment is a separation between revenue and then the finance expense that is already required in IAS 1. So that's why I'm thinking whatever will be in the revenue, in my eyes, it will be part of the underwriting or operating or whatever people want to think about. And then everything else that is going to P&L or in the OCI as an investment gains and losses, that will be part of investment result in essence. So the way I'm thinking about it, we kind of did it not directly through those decisions. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense?
I think I follow. And this almost latches onto Sue's previous point about thinking about whether we are articulating our objectives and whether or not we still have as an objective providing insight. If not, in terms of how you report on the face of the primary statements, then in the disclosure to help people understand the difference between those two.
So I think we provide it on the face. In the way that we present, this is the revenue.
I need to process that.
That's fine. I'm happy to talk.
Okay.
Stephen, you want to?
Yeah, I think the problem is this phrase separating underwriting and investing, because the OCI approach, I think, making more of it than actually it is by saying it's separating underwriting and investing. Sure, the impact of discount rate changes in the period is highlighted as a separate component of OCI. But this disclosure also is saying, well, let's highlight that as a separate component of P&L. So if that's what you mean by separating underwriting investing, it is separated. But But I've never thought that the OCI approach did separate underwriting and investing in the first place.
We go.
I suppose that explanation to responding to you. You know, when we start discussing whether we need OCI, we give different reasons, underwriting and others, or volatility and others. But by the end, you know, we already, you know, label something called, you know, impact of changes in discount rate in OCI. Then the other side still call the value from underwriting or others. Seems, you know, it's redundant. And secondly, you know, for non-accounting professionals, you know, use those kind of label, whether will increase understandability or decrease understandability, is hard to say. So I would not prefer to label something called underwriting.
So can we vote for the recommendation as a whole? Or?
Yes. B, C, D.
Except A, because we have
yeah,
already
A is already voted. So B, C,
all
D.
All decisions are tentative, so.
Yeah.
all in favour?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Shall we take a short break? Fast forward.